From Pacifica Network, this is Democracy Now!
We have a shared responsibility to fix Social Security and make the system better, to keep seniors out of poverty and expand ownership for people of every background.
In a primetime news conference, President Bush, for the first time, proposes to cut Social Security benefits as part of his overhaul plan. We'll get reaction from Democratic Congressmember Jim Moran. Then Condoleezza Rice is on a five-day tour of Latin America. We'll take a look at the latest developments in the region. And governments around the world are meeting next week at the United Nations to review the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty.
This Sunday, thousands of people from around the world will be gathering in New York Central Park to say no to nuclear weapons, no to the war in Iraq, and no to more nuclear excuses for war.
All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. President Bush had proposed for the first time cutting Social Security benefits for tens of millions of Americans in order to reduce the cost of the federal pension system. In his first primetime news conference in over a year, Bush outlined a system that would preserve benefits for low-income workers but cut benefits for everyone else. Under Bush's proposal, Social Security benefits would become pegged to inflation instead of wage growth. He estimated the deal would save $3 trillion over the next 75 years. This marks the first time the president has endorsed a plan that would reduce benefits for tens of millions of Americans. President Bush also repeated his call for the country to take steps to wean off foreign energy supplies. Bush said, quote, "My administration is doing everything we can to make gasoline more affordable." But his energy plan offered drivers no short-term relief from the high cost of gas at the pump. As consumers are paying near-record prices, it turns out gas companies are making record profits. On Thursday, ExxonMobil reported its first quarter earnings soared 44% over last year. ExxonMobil made more than $7.5 billion in the first 3 months of the year. Royal Dutch Shell recorded a 28% rise in profits, and ConocoPhillips has also recorded record profits. Part of the president's energy plans also calls for the construction of the country's first new nuclear power plants in a generation. The proposal comes as the world marks the 19th anniversary of the worst ever nuclear disaster at Chernobyl. A leading Russian scientist warned this week a second disaster looms in Chernobyl because of cracks in the reactor's decaying shell. If the shell collapsed, it could cause a catastrophe on the same scale as the original accident almost 20 years ago. In Iraq, at least 22 people have been killed today and dozens more injured in a series of bombings in Baghdad. The attacks come a day after Iraq's interim National Assembly approved part of the government's new cabinet lineup. Last night, President Bush refused to lay out any timetable for the withdrawal of U.S. troops from Iraq. Bush said, quote, "I believe we're making really good progress in Iraq." Earlier in the week, however, Joint Chiefs of Staff General Richard Myers admitted the Iraqis' resistance was still able to carry out as many attacks as a year ago. The Los Angeles Times is reporting the Bush administration has quietly forged a close intelligence partnership with the Sudanese government despite the country's role in the mass killings in Darfur. 8 months ago, then-Secretary of State Colin Powell accused Sudan of committing genocide. But relations appear to have since changed for the better. Although Sudan remains on the U.S. list of state sponsors of terrorism, it's been providing access to terrorism suspects and sharing intelligence data with the United States. The LA Times reports the CIA sent an executive jet last week to Khartoum to ferry the chief of Sudan's intelligence agency to Washington for secret meetings sealing Khartoum's sensitive and previously veiled partnership with the administration. One senior Sudanese official told Ken Silverstein of the Los Angeles Times the country had achieved complete normalization of relations with the CIA. In California, a jury has found police in Humboldt County used excessive force against nonviolent anti-logging protesters in 1997. During a series of protests, police applied pepper spray directly to the eyes of the demonstrators by swabbing their eyes with Q-tips covered in pepper spray. The jury awarded the protesters $1 each and ordered the police in Humboldt County and the city of Eureka to pay for the legal costs of the protesters. A former Army translator at Guantanamo Bay has accused the military of staging mock interrogations of detainees while politicians and military officials were visiting the base. The translator, Army Sergeant Eric Saar, told 60 Minutes, quote, "Interrogations were set up so the VIPs could come and witness an interrogation, a mock interrogation, basically. The U.S. is currently holding over 600 prisoners without charge at the base, but Saar said only a few dozen of the detainees were terrorists. Saar also recalled one female officer at the base once smeared red ink on the face of a detainee while telling him it was menstrual blood." The Pentagon has released more than 700 photographs of the country's war dead returning from Iraq and Afghanistan. Until now, the Pentagon has taken great steps to prevent the publication of photos of coffins returning from Iraq and Afghanistan. The Pentagon's releasing the photos now only after a journalism professor filed a Freedom of Information Act lawsuit. The photos are not untouched. The Pentagon decided to black out the faces of all troops accompanying the flag-draped coffin. A Pentagon spokesperson claimed this was needed to, quote, protect privacy and/or security information. Congresswoman Maxine Waters of California is calling for the Bush administration to explain why it sent over some 2,600 weapons to Haiti to supply the country's national police in violation of a 13-year-old arms embargo. The State Department admitted last week the shipment of arms that included M14 rifles and submachine guns. Waters specifically questioned the role of John Bolton in the arms shipment. At the time, Bolton was serving as the Undersecretary of State for Arms Control and International Security Affairs. Human rights groups have expressed serious concern over the reports of summary executions and arbitrary arrests carried out by the Haitian police. And bird watchers are rejoicing today. An ivory-billed woodpecker has been spotted for the first time in over 60 years. The bird was long assumed to be extinct. And on Thursday, the U.S. Postal Office unveiled a new stamp in memory of the famed lyricist Yip Harburg, who's best known for writing the words to Over the Rainbow. The government never offered him such tributes when he was alive. A lifelong socialist, he was blacklisted and hounded throughout much of his life. This is his song, Brother, Can You Spare a Dime? His name may not be known to many, but his songs are sung around the world. We begin with jazz singer Abby Lincoln.
Once I built a railroad, made it run, made it race against time.
And Tom Waits.
Once I built a railroad, and now it's done.
Judy Collins.
Buddy, can you spare a dime?
And Dr. John from New Orleans.
In khaki suits, you know, brother, he sure looks well. He was all full of that Yankee doodle-dee-doo.
Peter Yarrow.
Tumbling in boots, went slogging through hell, and I was a kid with a drum.
Say, don't you remember? Don't you remember? They called me Al. It was Al. Al all the time.
That's Al Jolson.
Don't you remember? I'm your pal. Say, buddy, can you spare down?
And our beloved Odetta.
Brother, Can You Spare a Dime? Lyricist Yip Harburg, the U.S. Post Office honoring him with a stamp this week. I'm Amy Goodman here with Juan Gonzalez on Democracy Now!
And welcome to all of our listeners and viewers around the country and the world. Well, during a nationally televised press conference last night, President Bush proposed for the first time cutting Social Security benefits for future retirees. The proposal, which is part of the president's plan to overhaul the retirement system, would preserve benefits for low-income workers but cut them for everyone else. The primetime news conference was the first of Bush's second term and only the fourth of his presidency. It comes at the end of a 60-day roadshow on Social Security in which the president argued that the retirement system is headed for financial collapse and should be overhauled to include private investment accounts.
The issue has turned out to be a politically divisive one in Washington. Over the past few months, virtually every Democrat, as well as many Republicans, are opposed to the plan. And a Washington Post ABC News poll this week found 51% of Americans are against it. In the hour-long news conference, President Bush also acknowledged the high price of gasoline and called on the Senate to pass his energy program, which includes drilling in a portion of the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge. He declined to offer a timetable for the withdrawal of American troops from Iraq and stood by his embattled nominee for United Nations Ambassador John Bolton. But it was Social Security that topped the agenda last night, the president again outlining his plan to overhaul the system.
When the baby boomers start retiring in 3 years, Social Security will start heading toward the red. In 2017, the system will start paying out more in benefits than it collects in payroll taxes. Every year after that, the shortfall will get worse, and by 2041, Social Security will be bankrupt. Franklin Roosevelt did a wonderful thing when he created Social Security. The system has meant a lot for a lot of people. Social Security has provided a safety net that has provided dignity and peace of mind for millions of Americans in their retirement. Yet there's a hole in the safety net because Congresses have made promises it cannot keep for a younger generation. As we fix Social Security, some things won't change. Seniors and people with disabilities will get their checks. All Americans born before 1950 will receive the full benefits. Our duty to save Social Security begins with making the system permanently solvent, but our duty does not end there. We also have a responsibility to improve Social Security by directing extra help to those most in need and by making it a better deal for younger workers. Now, as Congress begins work on legislation, we must be guided by three goals. First, millions of Americans depend on Social Security checks as a primary source of retirement income, so we must keep this promise to future retirees as well. As a matter of fairness, I propose that future generations receive benefits equal to or greater than the benefits today's seniors get. Secondly, I believe a reform system should protect those who depend on Social Security the most. So I propose a Social Security system in the future where benefits for low-income workers will grow faster than benefits for people who are better off. By providing more generous benefits for low-income retirees, we'll make this commitment. If you work hard and pay into Social Security your entire life, you will not retire into poverty. This reform would solve most of the funding challenges facing Social Security. A variety of options are available to solve the rest of the problem, and I will work with Congress on any good faith proposal that does not raise the payroll tax rate or harm our economy. I know we can find a solution to the financial problems of Social Security that is sensible, permanent, and fair. Third, any reform of Social Security must replace the empty promises being made to younger workers with real assets, real money. I believe the best way to achieve this goal is to give younger workers the option, the opportunity, if they so choose, of putting a portion of their payroll taxes into a voluntary personal retirement account. Because this money is saved and invested, younger workers would have the opportunity to receive a higher rate of return on their money than the current Social Security system can provide.
President Bush in his primetime news conference last night. Joining us on the phone for reaction is Virginia Democratic Congressmember Jim Moran. Welcome to Democracy Now!
Thank you. It's an honor to be on the station.
Well, thanks very much. Can you respond to President Bush's plans for Social Security?
First of all, Social Security is a national insurance system. It's not an investment account. It's there in case the breadwinner of the household dies. Their survivors will have at least money to get by on. Or if you become disabled, you can get those benefits. Or when you are so old that you can't work any longer, there will be retirement money available for you. But it's a minimum threshold. We have retirement accounts, 401ks, IRAs, your passbook savings account. We need a national insurance system. And I think what President Bush is going to do is to means test it, which on the face of it makes a lot of sense, except that it will lose the political support of the people who have the power and the influence in this country. The reason Social Security is such a popular topic now is that everybody participates. If he cuts the benefits for the middle class and upper class by 40%, which is what this plan entails, fewer people will really care what happens to Social Security. And that's not in anybody's interest. Last night, we passed a budget resolution that took billions out of the TANF program. Does anybody even know what TANF means? It's the old welfare program. It's assistance to needy families. But because there's so little political support for it, it goes by without much discussion. The Medicaid program, we took $10 billion from that last night, supposedly so that we could afford the tax cuts of over $100 billion. The only reason people talk about Medicaid is because the states are upset they might have to make up the money. It's a 50% state matching program. What happens is that if you means test this, and it's only the poorer people who have a vested interest in maintaining it, it won't be maintained. And I think that's what President Bush has in mind. The only thing that is really fiscally solvent of any size in this country is the Social Security Trust Fund. It's not going bankrupt. Our country is going bankrupt. Last night, as part of the budget resolution, they increased the debt ceiling to over $8 trillion. We have a $10 trillion economy, but we've got a debt of 80% of that economy. He doesn't seem to be concerned about that. Our health care crisis is in bankruptcy, but here he's taken on Social Security, which has a $1.7 trillion surplus. We're gaining surplus every year. In 2018, we'll have $4.5 trillion. And then from that time, for another approximately 35 to 40 years, there'll be enough to pay out full benefits, and after that, about 80% of benefits. That's not bankruptcy, and it's wrong to be telling people the system is going bankrupt so that you can pass an ideologically motivated plan basically to dismantle the whole system.
Well, Congressman Moran, I'd like to ask you, you mentioned before that other Americans have a variety of retirement plans, like whether it's 401ks or pensions, but isn't this reform occurring against a backdrop that many of the so-called classic pension plans, the defined benefit plans, are also experiencing enormous financial problems in the airline industry and the automobile industry, so that Social Security is becoming an even more important sort of final safety net for retired workers because so many Americans now don't have defined benefit pension plans, but are depending basically on 401ks or the stock market itself to assure their retirement income?
Well, the answer, I think, is yes and no. Under his plan, if you earn over $25,000, your benefits are going to be reduced. It's if you're under $25,000, then you'll keep the same benefits, and it'll be based upon wage-based indexing, so it goes up every year. But that's not going to make up for the loss of your pension. What we should be doing with regard to pensions is making sure that these corporate raiders can't come in and buy up companies and take advantage of all that cash. We should have better protections for pensions. We have some, but increasingly. We are yielding to corporate profit over the pension guarantees. I think that this is all about dismantling a program that is defining of what the Democratic Party was all about, that was established by Franklin Roosevelt. It's the one program that really is solvent. So why should we make it insolvent by taking approximately $2 trillion over the first 10 years, $5 trillion over the next 20 years, and taking that money out of the fund, fencing it off, putting it in private accounts? These private accounts, you know, are not going to amount to much when people retire, because the Social Security system says it's going to come back in and take out of those accounts the amount that Social Security would have earned otherwise. The Goldman Sachs economist just estimated that Social Security will earn about 3.3%. It's actually earning over 7% per year now, but it'll earn about 3.3%, which is as much as they estimate the stock market is going to be earning on average over that period of time. So they're going to be left with very little. But in the meantime, we will have borrowed trillions out of the trust funds, then out of the general fund to make it up to the trust fund. So we're creating a situation of fiscal insolvency in order to dismantle a program that is the last one we need to worry about right now. We need to be worrying about Medicare. We need to be worrying about the federal budget and the hundreds of billions that our kids are going to have to pay in interest costs on that federal deficit. So, you know, I just think he has his priorities out of order. I think this is all about ideology rather than fiscal responsibility.
Congressmember Jim Marone, we want to ask you to stay with us for a minute longer. We want to ask you about rendition, his response to that question, what some call kidnapping. Congressmember Jim Moran is from Virginia. He's going to be holding a town hall meeting today on protecting Social Security in Falls Church, Virginia. And then we're going to talk about Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice's trip throughout Latin America. Stay with us.
Meu sapato já furou, minha roupa já rasgou. Eu não tenho onde morar, onde morar. Meu dinheiro acabou, eu não sei pra onde vou. Como é que eu vou ficar, que eu vou ficar? Eu não sei nem mais sorrir, meu amor me abandonou. Sem motivo e sem razão. E pra melhorar minha situação, eu fiz promessa pra São Luís Durão. Meu sapato já furou.
Meu sapato já furou, minha roupa já rasgou. Eu não tenho onde morar,
onde morar.
Meu dinheiro acabou, eu não sei pra onde vou. Como é que eu vou ficar,
eu vou ficar.
Eu não sei nem mais sorrir, meu amor me abandonou. Sem motivo e sem razão. E pra melhorar minha situação, eu fiz promessa pra São Luís Durão.
Até pensar que eu cheguei ao fim. Mas quando a minha vida melhorar, eu vou zombar de quem sorriu de mim. Meu sapato já furou.
Meu sapato já furou. Minha roupa já rasgou. Eu não tenho onde morar.
Onde morar?
Meu dinheiro acabou. Eu não sei pra onde vou. Como é que eu vou ficar?
Que eu vou ficar?
Eu não sei nem mais sorrir. Meu amor me abandonou. Sem razão. E pra melhorar minha situação, eu fiz promessa pra São Luís Durão.
Meu sapato já furou.
Clara Nunez here on Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. During the Thursday night news conference, President Bush defended sending detainees to other countries for interrogation. Some call it kidnapping. Others call it extraordinary rendition. Here's the reporter who asked the question.
Mr. President, under the law, how would you justify the practice of renditioning, where U.S. agents scoop up terror suspects abroad, taking them to a third country for interrogation? And would you stand for it if foreign agents did that to an American here?
Now, that's a hypothetical, Mark. We operate within the law, and we send people to countries where they say they're not going to torture the people. But let me say something. The United States government has an obligation to protect the American people. It's in our country's interest to find those who would do harm to us and get them out of harm's way. And we will do so within the law, and we'll do so in honoring our commitment not to torture people. And we expect the countries where we send somebody to not to torture as well. But you bet, when we find somebody who may do harm to the American people, we will detain them and ask others from their country of origin to detain them. It makes sense. The American people expect us to do that. We're still at war.
That's President Bush answering a question on what has called rendition. Congressmember Jim Moran, Democrat of Virginia, your response.
Well, it's only lawful because they make their own law. It's wrong. And, you know, if any of President Bush's family, if either of his daughters were ever arrested in any of those countries, he'd move heaven and earth to get them out of there because he knows they do torture. Those prisons are inhumane hell holes, and it's wrong to do that. And it's particularly disturbing to the character of people who say, oh, I wasn't responsible, when they are responsible for transporting them, knowing somebody else is going to carry out their dirty work. You know, we've had all this rhetoric about how horrible these undemocratic countries are, but when we want to use them, we take advantage of the fact that they're undemocratic, that their people are powerless to express opposition to their policies, particularly their penal policies. I think that this is just more of the same, figuring they can get away with anything they want to because that they have this supreme hubris. And I'm ashamed of my country that we would when we send people to countries knowing they're going to be tortured because we don't want to be responsible for the actions that ultimately we are responsible for. It's wrong.
Congressmember Jim Moran, I want to thank you for being with us of Virginia again, holding a public town hall meeting in Falls Church, Virginia today with the former acting Social Security Commissioner Bill Halter. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, as we broadcast in over 330 stations around the country, Pacifica and NPR stations, public access TV and PBS stations, and on both TV satellite networks, on Dish Network, Channel 9415, Free Speech TV, 9410, Link TV, as well as on DirecTV, Channel 375. And we video and audio stream at democracynow.org. Juan?
Well, on Tuesday, Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice began a 5-day tour of Latin America. By the end of her trip, she will have visited Brazil, Colombia, Chile, and El Salvador. Rice has billed her tour as an effort to, quote, bolster democracy and alleviate poverty. This is the Secretary speaking Wednesday in Brazil.
Our world is moving toward greater freedom and democracy. And President Bush has outlined the charge of our times. Those of us who are on the right side of freedom's divide have an obligation to those who are still on the wrong side of that divide.
That was Condoleezza Rice speaking from Brazil. But the Bush administration's worried about several countries in Latin America moving increasingly towards the left. In recent weeks, popular protests in Ecuador forced out that country's president, Lucio Gutierrez. Gutierrez took office in January 2003 as a populist anti-corruption reformer, but soon angered many Ecuadorians by adopting economic austerity measures drawn up by the International Monetary Fund. Gutierrez is the latest on a long list of neoliberal Latin American politicians thrown out of office in elections or by popular revolt.
During the last 5 years, uprisings have overthrown governments in Ecuador, Peru, Argentina, and Bolivia. In Brazil, Chile, and Venezuela, governments have been elected on anti-neoliberal platforms. In Uruguay, leftist President Tabaré Vázquez was recently elected. And much to the dismay of the Bush administration, one of his first moves after being sworn into office was to restore full diplomatic relations with Cuba. Left-wing forces are considered to have a serious chance in upcoming presidential elections in Mexico, Nicaragua, and Peru. And yesterday in Colombia, Rice defended the United States government's more than $3 billion in military assistance to aid that country's efforts to counter cocaine production and to stop the left-wing insurgency.
We're going to turn now to Kimberly Stanton, Deputy Director of the Washington Office in Latin America. First, though, we're going to take a look at a country Condoleezza Rice is not visiting, but seems to be the focus of much of this trip, and that's Venezuela. Relations have been bitter between the U.S. and Venezuela since the U.S. tacitly supported the 2002 coup that briefly ousted Venezuelan President Hugo Chavez. In recent weeks, there's been rising tensions. Last Sunday, Chavez ended a 35-year military cooperation agreement with the U.S. and ordered out four American military instructors he accused of fomenting unrest inside the country. And the New York Times has reported the Bush administration is considering funneling more money to foundations, business, and political groups opposed to Chavez's government. We welcome you to Democracy Now!, Kimberly Stanton.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be with you.
Can you talk about Venezuela and how it fits into this trip, not on the itinerary of the Secretary of State?
No, it's not on the itinerary, but it seems to have been a topic of conversation pretty much everywhere, both in questions she's received, but clearly with governments, and I think in particular with Brazil, I expect with Chile as well. She's looking for allies in a somewhat quiet, not that quiet effort, I think, to try to isolate Chavez from other Latin American countries, to try to set him apart as not being consistent with the kind of democracy or the kind of economic policy the United States would like to see. She's not getting much positive response. President Lula has been very clear that Brazil sees Chavez and sees Venezuela as a sovereign country. Even on the issue, the new controversial issue of arms purchases by Venezuela, Brazil is saying that countries have certainly a right to defend themselves, a right to maintain the armament for their armed forces. Even Colombia, which has had some tense moments with Venezuela lately, Foreign Minister Carolina Barco explicitly said that they recognize the right of Venezuela to defend themselves. So, I mean, this is a situation where Chavez's rhetoric has been unfortunate and more inflammatory than constructive, but the U.S. government's response has been also of a kind. And rather than working multilaterally to provide the sort of regional and sub-regional security assurances needed to calm down the situation, she seems to be looking for support for further isolation. It's not a policy that's going to work.
Well, in terms of the Venezuela situation, hasn't actually the Venezuelan government been able to develop closer ties with many Latin American countries by utilizing its oil, signing preferential treaties or arrangements with several other countries in terms of supplying them oil, and thus cementing closer ties within the region vis-a-vis the United States?
Absolutely. Venezuela has strong ties. It sells. It has a policy of being willing to sell oil below market prices to its sister countries in the region. And there's tremendous commerce. I'm sorry? There's tremendous commerce between Venezuela and Colombia, for example, and with Brazil. So from an interest-based perspective, Latin American countries also don't have any reason or any desire to be drawn in between a debate or a fight between the U.S. and Venezuela.
We are joined right now by Greg Wilpert in Caracas, Venezuela, and would like to get the latest there, Greg. We welcome you to Democracy Now! The trip that Condoleezza Rice is not taking to Venezuela, but the impact in Caracas right now.
Well, hi. The impact has been generally that every time that Condoleezza Rice criticizes Chavez, his popularity goes up within Venezuela and probably also to some extent within the rest of Latin America. I mean, it's pretty much a transparent move. What Condoleezza Rice is trying to do is to isolate Venezuela with respect to the rest of Latin America. But just as a recent New York Times article pointed out, it's almost the opposite that is happening, that in that process, the U.S. is isolating itself with respect to the rest of Latin America. Chavez has been signing all kinds of trade agreements and cooperation agreements with every country in Latin America and has been really pushing hard for the integration of Latin America. So the isolation of Venezuela is very, very far from happening.
I'd like to ask Kimberly Stanton the situation in Mexico. This whole development of virtually all the major Latin American countries electing populist governments, there's basically two major exceptions at this point, Colombia and Mexico, but yet the situation in Mexico seems to be reaching a crisis point in terms and a possibility that if you do have a progressive or leftist president elected in Mexico, the entire region will essentially begin to spiral out of U.S. control.
Well, there's a couple of points there. I actually, I think it is likely that Mexico may well end up electing the current mayor of Mexico City in its next round of elections. And in some ways, or well, many ways, the current government has actually made that more likely by a not very sophisticated effort to prevent him from running through a series of judicial challenges that have now caused a crisis in the country. But I think the larger question is, why should the U.S. fear the election of left-leaning leaders? I mean, this is a reaction of people making use of democratic institutions and looking for a different response, a different policy response, a different policy orientation after 20 years of experience with what normally get called sort of more right-of-center, especially neoliberal economic policies, and without seeing many results. Democracy is a system in which political parties alternate in power, leaders alternate in power, political orientations alternate. It's part of the normal give and take. It has happened in the United States. It's happened in Europe. It's happened any place where democracy works. So I think the shift to the left in Latin America is a reflection of the failure on the economic and social policy side to respond to deeply felt needs that, unfortunately, current economic policies aren't helping to redress. But I don't see any reason why, given that leaders are being elevated through elections and through popular participatory processes, why the United States should treat this as a threat or a concern. It seems to me it's a reflection, a very healthy reflection of the consolidation of democracy to have popular unrest channeled through democratic institutions and not through insurgencies.
Greg Wilpert in Caracas, journalist and sociologist. What about the accusations that Venezuela is arming the FARC in Colombia?
Well, there's been absolutely no evidence that any arms have gone from Venezuela, or at least from the government, to the FARC. This is an accusation that has been around since the beginning, since Chavez has been first elected, but nobody's ever presented any concrete proof of it. And actually, that specific accusation hasn't been made as often as for lack of proof, as the accusation that Chavez is providing them other forms of support, whether it's money or a safe haven within Venezuela. But even those accusations are pretty hollow. I mean, certainly there are a lot of border crossings where FARC, but also AUC, the paramilitaries, and also even Colombian official military come across the Venezuelan border. But that's exactly the point that Venezuela is trying to prevent, actually, with the arms purchases that it's making. It's buying patrol boats, it's buying patrol airplanes, and it's buying small weapons, which it hasn't made any major purchases in almost 20 years. So all of their weapons are basically antiquated, and actually 20 years ago they made much larger purchases, long before Chavez ever got elected, and the U.S. government didn't say a thing, mainly because it bought almost all of its weapons from the U.S. This time it's going to Russia and to China and to Brazil to buy these other weapons, and so of course the U.S. government is up in arms, literally, because it's not getting the benefit. Plus, it's trying to use it as a wedge to isolate Venezuela. But as I said before, that's probably not going to happen.
Greg, speaking of arms, the arm of oil. Apparently, the increase in the price of oil on the world market has only strengthened President Chavez's ability to implement many of his social programs and to assist other Latin American neighbors. Could you talk about that a little bit?
Yeah, I mean, the oil income has gone up tremendously in the last couple of years, last 2 years, and it had, of course, also a tremendous impact on the Venezuelan economy, which grew 17%, I think it was, last year, and which was one of the highest rates of any country in the world, actually. Of course, that was after the coup and the oil strike and so on. But so now Chavez has been using that essentially to fund the social programs, and they've been really quite effective in the sense that a tremendous number of Venezuelans are benefiting from them. And they've put small community clinics in almost every single neighborhood throughout Venezuela, and have opened subsidized food markets also that benefit something like almost half of the Venezuelan population now. So the impact is definitely being felt of this oil wealth coming to the people, which is something that hasn't happened in Venezuela also since the last oil boom, at least over 20 years ago. So that's one of the reasons, of course, that Chavez has become very popular, in addition to the fact, of course, that people feel like he's, the poor of Venezuela feel like he's the first president to support them, which hasn't happened in actually almost ever. The previous presidents were always presidents of the middle class, essentially. And, of course, that's also being used now to buy these weapons, like I said.
Kimberly Stanton of Washington Office in Latin America. A quick question. Do you think that Iraq saved Chavez, that with the U.S. distracted by the wars in Afghanistan and Iraq, that this is helps to explain what has happened in Latin America? And then if you could quickly comment on what's happened in Ecuador.
I don't think that the U.S. was so distracted by Iraq that it wasn't paying attention to Venezuela, although it wasn't paying attention perhaps to many other parts of Latin America. The U.S. has been very clear in its opposition to Chavez from the beginning. It's important to remember that the way the Venezuelan opposition first tried to remove him from power was through a coup attempt, and that was followed by the strike that was just mentioned, which was devastating to the Venezuelan economy. And only then did the effort shift to trying to vote him out of office. And the U.S. agencies have certainly provided plenty of funding to opposition groups, specifically in an effort to mobilize people to vote against him in the referendum last fall and to continue to build up capacity to eventually push him out of office. Just before Ms. Rice left for Latin America, unnamed State Department officials talked about the possibility of an even more confrontational strategy and increasing even more the funding going to these kinds of opposition groups. So I don't think Venezuela's been off the agenda of the State Department, although it's been handled in a way that has actually, as your guests, other guests have commented, both strengthens popular support for Mr. Chavez within Venezuela and has also pushed the national security concerns onto the agenda for Venezuela. If you look over the last 5 or 6 years, Mr. Chavez hasn't been focused on defending security, defending Venezuela's security or defending his own security per se. It's as a result of the last year and a half of concerted pressure on him and the clear escalation of opposition that the security concerns have started to come back onto the scene. And an event that happened a few months ago where Colombia went into Venezuela and picked off a FARC leader who'd been living pretty openly there and had actually crossed the Colombian border a number of times and had Colombian immigration stamps in his passport under his normal name, so clearly could have been picked up in some other way. When Colombia paid security forces in Venezuela to pick up this guy and who was then transported over the border and whatnot, they raised all sorts of concerns, both or reinforced concerns of some kind of conspiracy to move into Venezuela and some kind of fear on Chavez's part that in fact he's far more vulnerable than he realized. So I think in short, Venezuela's been on the agenda, but not in a constructive way, or not as constructive as it should have been for quite a while. The situation in Ecuador is another case of...
Just 30 seconds. Said,
okay. It's a case of people demanding the political accountability from their leaders, not getting it through democratic institutions, and so taking to the streets. So another president has, in fact, been voted out of office, Lucio Gutierrez. But it's important to note that Mr. Gutierrez's removal was preceded by several months of clearly unconstitutional actions on his part, which didn't awaken very much active or concerted response either by the U.S. or even by the OAS. There were some statements by the OAS and UN, but not much concern until he was removed. There's an opportunity in Ecuador now to reconstitute the institutions, to restructure them, and we hope that the new president will move in that way to try to bring institutions and popular sentiment more into line and to make the institutions more functional.
I want to thank you both for being with us. Kimberly Stanton, Deputy Director of the Washington Office on Latin America, WOLA, joining us from Washington, D.C., and Greg Wilpert, a journalist and sociologist living in Caracas, Venezuela. This is Democracy Now! When we come back, we'll talk about a new bill that has a great deal of impact on immigrants, and then the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty meetings next week and a major protest this weekend. Stay with us.
I hear a bird, a Glacamora bird. It well may be he's bringing me a cheering word. I hear a breeze, a River Shannon breeze. It well may be it's followed me across the seas. Then tell me, please, how are things in Glacamora? Is that little brook still leaping? Does it still run down to Donegal through Killybegs, Kilkerry and Kildare? How are things in Glacamora? Is that willow tree still weeping there? Does that lassie with the twinkling eye come smiling by? And does she walk away sad and dreamy there?
How are things in Glacamora? Considered an immigrant national anthem. The lyrics by Yip Harburg, the U.S. Post Office, honoring him this week with a postage stamp. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Mimi Goodman with Juan Gonzalez.
Well, Congress is poised to pass a law as an anti-terrorism measure that could have a significant impact on immigrant rights in this country. The Real ID Act would make sweeping changes to the nation's system for issuing driver's licenses and would overturn laws in 9 states that currently allow undocumented workers to obtain driver's licenses. Another set of provisions raises the standard for granting asylum for those fleeing persecution.
The House sent the bill to the Senate as part of a must-pass appropriations measure for troops in Iraq and tsunami relief. Neither chamber has held hearings or held through discussions on the measure. 6 Republican senators last week signed a letter asking Senate Majority Leader Bill Frist not to let the so-called Real ID Act appear in the final bill. They wrote, quote, "Legislating in such a complex area without the benefit of hearings and expert testimony is a dubious exercise and one that subverts the Senate's deliberative process." Despite the objections, House Republicans are pushing to keep the Real ID Act in the final conference report. American Civil Liberties Union has been joined by a number of groups in opposing the measure, and the Boston Globe, New York Newsday, and Washington Post have all come out with editorials against the legislation. We're joined now by Arti Shahani, an organizer with the immigrant advocacy group Families for Freedom, based in New York. Welcome to Democracy Now!
Hi.
Can you lay out just what this bill is?
Let me talk quickly about what it is and the process that's just sort of repeating itself historically. The Real ID Act is a sweeping measure to curtail immigrants' rights in terms of livelihood, like driver's licenses, as Juan had mentioned, in terms of access to courts if they're being deported. For the first time since the Civil War, the Real ID Act actually proposes to suspend habeas corpus. Now, for anyone who's read the Constitution, I'm not sure the Congress members have, but for anyone who has read the Constitution, habeas is a constitutional right. Other things the Real ID does is it empowers bounty hunters, private police forces, to go ahead and arrest immigrants that may be in deportation proceedings with virtually no oversight. It also gives the Department of Homeland Security carte blanche to basically go ahead and do what it wants to at the border. I don't know if they're trying to create a little Iraq at the border. I'm not sure what they're trying to do at the border, but that's basically what Real ID does. Quickly, why this is so terrifying is a matter of process. I mean, the bill itself is a monster, and I think that there are certain people in Congress that have been itching to pass something like this. They've tried time and time again. Last year it didn't work, and now they're trying to get it through quietly with the appropriations bill. But just historically, the last time Congress made sweeping anti-immigrant measures was in 1996, and they did it the exact same way. They couldn't get it to pass through the House and Senate independently, so they tacked it onto an appropriations bill. A conference committee got together. At midnight, they made final changes, and kabam, you get an anti-immigrant bill that is having lasting impacts on us. So that's briefly what it's about.
And what is the likelihood now of being able to get the Senate to, or Bill Frist, to pull this out of conference legislation?
Well, that's part of what I think is so scary about the process right now, because we're over here, we're all dying to know what's going to happen, but it's closed door. Everything we're hearing from little peeps of information in D.C. is, this is going through. And that's crazy, because last week we thought, okay, the Senate did not vote to include it. It's not going to go through. But at this point, it seems it actually might go through. And so, I mean, just if I can, I want to get right to the point. Mm-hmm. Whether or not it goes through, we have to try our best to stop it, because I would hate to see people not knowing about it until it's passed and the damage is done, and then we mourn the fact that our Constitution doesn't matter, people can't drive in this country without proving that they're citizens, et cetera, et cetera. But for anyone that does have a moment, the one little thing people can do is call the White House comments line at 202-456-1111 and give a comment. Say that you're against it. They actually might be counting these things. It might matter if enough people are aghast. Maybe they'll actually stop it. But I can say what's, you know, just in terms of the types of things that this will permit if it's passed, with habeas, for example. Habeas is like the emergency valve you pull when the government is doing something wrong to you. It's the thing that you file to say, my arrest is unlawful, my detention is unlawful, my deportation is unlawful. And Real ID would take habeas away. So there's no safety valve anymore.
What happens to asylum seekers?
The same thing. I mean, they're extremely harsh and ridiculous barriers post on asylum seekers. So, for example, you could be someone who's fleeing genital mutilation or a corrupt government, have plenty of documentation, but at some point it won't matter anymore. Like, it's ridiculously high barriers. The one little thing that people might not realize as well about it is that with the driver's license provisions, there are insurance companies around the country that are like, this is crazy. Why would you want people to drive without a license? And people are going to have to drive without a license. I mean, we don't ride bicycles in America. We drive cars, you know?
But beside calling the White House, what else can listeners who'd like to weigh in on this do?
They can also call the Capitol switchboard and try to talk to members of the Appropriations Committee. The number for that is 202-224-3121. If you want more information, there's plenty online about it. You could visit familiesforfreedom.org. That's familiesplural4freedom.org. But I think that the other thing just to point out is that in the Senate, Democrats have had absolutely no backbone about this stuff. Feinstein of California actually tried to pass a sense of the Senate bill to stop immigration provisions from being thrown into the military appropriations. And Chuck Schumer, our own Chuck Schumer in New York, decided not to support that. So you have a small pocket of senators that are saying, listen, we're not saying we're for it or against it. We're just saying we have to have a debate. And then you have people like Schumer that theoretically governs a state of immigrants that is not even standing up for that.
Arti Shahani, I want to thank you very much for being with us of the immigrant advocacy group Families for Freedom here in New York. Juan?
Well, on Monday, May 2nd, nearly all of the governments in the world will meet at the United Nations to review the Nuclear Nonproliferation Treaty, a review conference that takes place every 5 years. A coalition of over 2,000 organizations around the world have teamed up with United for Peace and Justice to organize a big march and rally this Sunday, the day before the conference opens, to demand global nuclear disarmament. Thousands of people are expected to attend, including the mayors of Hiroshima and Nagasaki.
Joining us in our studio is Rihanna Tyson, program manager of Reaching Critical Will, which is a project of the Women's International League for Peace and Freedom, known as WILF. She's based at the United Nations. Welcome to Democracy Now!
Thank you very much.
Can you talk about Sunday and then the next week?
Sure. First, I would actually like to say a little bit about the treaty itself and what this conference is to explain why thousands of people from around the world are coming here. This treaty is reviewed every 5 years, but what makes this year particularly interesting and important is that the treaty is basically in its biggest crisis to date. As you know, U.S. keeps threatening that Iran is developing nuclear weapons. North Korea withdrew from the treaty. Other questionable activities have popped up around the world, but the nuclear weapon states themselves, while threatening and accusing all these other countries, have completely reneged on their disarmament commitments in the treaty and in international law as well. They're also modernizing and upgrading their own arsenals, thereby provoking others to develop nuclear weapons, which in turn gives the U.S. justification to go to war. So at this particular time, with the growing peace movement, the movement against the Iraq war, thousands of us are going to be in Central Park to say, adhere to your disarmament commitments, no to the war in Iraq, and no to any more nuclear excuses for war. So we have labor groups coming, we have environmental groups coming, youth, dozens of Hibakusha, the atomic bomb survivors, are coming. Not just the mayors of Hiroshima and Nagasaki, but mayors from all over the world will be marching through the heart of Manhattan and rallying at Central Park at 2 o'clock on Sunday.
What does it really mean to have this conference next week? I mean, is this sort of UN bureaucracy, or does it have meaning?
It can have meaning. It's actually not a UN conference. It just happens to be held at the UN. That's the forum of choice. What can happen is that they can come up with a package of decisions that are politically binding. They can put time frames for disarmament. They can tighten the rules for non-proliferation and the trade in so-called peaceful uses of nuclear technology. The problem now is that the package of decisions that was adopted in 2000, the Bush administration has completely ripped up and said that has no more relevance in a post-September 11th world. By doing that, it is they that are undermining not only the NPT review process, but international law as a whole. What's the point of negotiating till 4 in the morning, as they did in 2000, if it can be so easily discarded? So really, this is about not just upholding disarmament law, but international law as a whole.
And for people who want more information about the march and rally or the conference, where can they go?
About the march and rally, the best place to go is either unitedforpeace.org or abolitionnow.org. And to follow the developments of the conference itself, reachingcriticalwill.org, we do daily reporting from that conference throughout the month of May.
And finally, President Bush in his news conference last night talked about new development of nuclear power plants. Does that have any impact on this?
We believe the Women's International League for Peace and Freedom, as well as Abolition 2000, the coalition that you mentioned, are strongly opposed to nuclear energy. We believe that nuclear energy powers the bomb. So for the U.S. to continually promote nuclear energy will give not only the justification, but the technology for others to proliferate, which again is further justification for future wars.
Rihanna Tyson, thanks very much for
being with us.
Of Reaching Critical Will, project of the Women's International League for Peace and Freedom, based at the United Nations. And that does it for today's program. We'll be in Arizona this weekend, Tucson tonight at the Tucson Convention Center, and tomorrow day, Scottsdale, Arizona at the Sun Festival, tomorrow night in Flagstaff, Arizona at Northern Arizona University at the Du Bois Center. You can sign up for our Daily Digest email list, get our daily headlines and media alerts at democracynow.org. Democracy Now! Is produced by Mike Burke, Sharif Odokadus, John Hamilton, Anna Noguera, Elizabeth Press, Yoruba Richin, and Jeremy Scahill. Mike DeFilippo and Ryan Abernathy are our engineers. Special thanks to our director, Uri Galed, Angela Alston, our technical director, Chris Zucker, Jenny Filippazzo, Phillips, Dennis Moynihan, and the whole team that makes this program possible. I'm Amy Goodman, here with Juan Gonzalez for another edition of Democracy Now!